அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களது காலை வணக்கங்கள். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதாரவிந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று வெப் மீட்டிங் லைஃப் டிவைன் சாப்டர்ஸ் மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகரன் அவர்களும் தி நாட் ஆஃப் மேட்டர் என்ற தலைப்பில் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். அன்பர்கள் அனைவரும் அன்னையின் அருளை பெறுமாறு தாழ்மையுடன் வேண்டிக் கொள்கிறோம்.
Thank you, Vijaya. Good morning. Today we are going to cover Sriramanda chapter 25 in book 1, The Knot of Matter. In a sense, this is the most important chapter in book 1, because up until now we have been talking high philosophy, but in this chapter Sri Aurobindo comes to the crux of the problem. Divine life sounds like a very inspiring idea. We would all like to enjoy it. But the distance between where we are and divine life seems to be very bit great. And we have enough trouble with human life. How are we to overcome the problems of human life? Where's the question of divine life? So in this chapter, he starts in chapter 1, the human aspiration, by telling us, don't worry. You have nothing to worry about because divine life is inevitable. In spite of all that we are, in spite of all that we do, it's inevitable. It's very comforting to us. Oh, you mean I can just continue as I am and anyway I will arrive at the goal. It's like being on a 747. You can sleep the whole way. It doesn't matter. You're going there. In this chapter, he tells us the other side of the story. The obstacles to divine life are enormous. And the crux of those obstacles is in matter. Because matter is a knot. So in order to really understand what that knot is, let us first consider what he means by divine life. And we can compare where we are with where we want to go and what stands in the way. By divine life, he means a life where everything will go change for the better. Not just better. Best, more than best imaginable. What does he mean? First of all, we'll have total knowledge. Total knowledge. What does it mean? No ignorance, no error, no trial and error, no experimentation on how to make the dosa or the sambar, or trying to find the right bridegroom. Or get admission. No falsehood. It means there'll be no Mr. Darcy who struts around feeling very important and falsely having the idea that he's a highly cultured man and everybody else is inferior. Which means, of course, if we feel superior to anybody, we can be very sure we're in the human life. Not the divine life. We're in the ignorance. In divine life, the first time Darcy sees Elizabeth, he won't look at her dress. He won't look at the fact nobody's dancing with her. Her appearance is tolerable. You'll see directly the light of her soul. Like Savitri, when she was driving through the forest in the chariot, and Satyavan appeared for the first time out of the forest on the path, she looked and saw that very handsome looking man, and then she looked back and started going, and then suddenly something in her soul jumped and said, wait a minute, and she called and she seized the horses to stop. Suddenly the whole train stopped, and she immediately saw, this is the man I have been looking for 1 year, for my whole life. This is my soulmate. That's what we will have, the knowledge we will have in the divine life. In divine life, nobody will believe even for a moment Wickham's scandalous falsehood about Darcy. He'll be incapable of believing a vibration of falsehood. Bingley will never doubt even for a second Jane's genuine affection for him. No matter what anybody whispers in his ear, Darcy says, no, no, she's not really interested. He will never question. He will know. When Elizabeth comes to Mr. Bennet and says, you better not send Lydia to Brighton. Well, you see, I want some peace and quiet. Nothing will happen. Nobody's interested in her. She has no money. He will never make that mistake even for a moment, because he'll have true knowledge. In divine life, there'll be no pain, no suffering, only joy. If Lydia ever elopes in the divine life, and Lizzie gets the letter, and Darcy comes, and Darcy says, well, I will leave you now, Lizzie will never make the mistake of saying, I will never see that man again. I know he will never look at me again. Now my family is contaminated. My reputation is ruined. All is lost. It's a hopeless case. She'll never have that moment of suffering out of a sense of hopelessness or despair. If Bingley rushes off to London, Jane will never feel deserted. Well, it's all over. It looked nice. It was great, but it's all over. If anything doesn't happen, it only means something better is going to happen and is preparing the way. If the entail comes to Collins, Mrs. Bennet will say, well, we must be meant for something better than that. In divine life, there's only harmony based on a sense of oneness. This is not the harmony that comes by let's compromise, let's come to mutual understanding. You give a little, I give a little, like that. This is the harmony that we have because we are one. And we feel the joy of that oneness. There can be no sense of quarrel. Competition doesn't arise. The right hand and the left hand don't compete with one another. We don't compete with our image reflection in the mirror. Because there'll be no ego. Because all our problems, all our pain, all our suffering, all our disharmony arises out of sense of ego. Either we feel superior to other people, which is a formula for misery, or we feel inferior to other people, which is pure falsehood. None of that can exist in the divine life. In divine life, Mrs. Bennet won't try to dominate Lady Lucas and humiliate her or tell her husband what to do and have the joy of ordering everybody about or scheming to send Jane on horseback. Caroline will not be jealous when Darcy starts admiring Elizabeth. Lady Catherine will not oppose Lizzie's marriage engagement to him. Most importantly, in divine life, there'll be total power for accomplishment. The idea of failure doesn't arise. We'll be able to do anything, everything we want to do. Money will be valueless, because anything we want, we don't need money in order to attain it. We have the power. There'll be no sense of limitation, no sense of want. In divine life, there'll be no disease, there'll be no death. Disease comes from disharmony, death comes from rigidity and incapacity to change. The soul is constantly changing, the body wants to stay where it is, and it gets more and more apart, and finally the soul says, let's get rid of this thing and get something that, this is an old horse carriage, I need a jet. so let me get a new body. Everything will be in perpetual balance and equilibrium and capable of constant adaptation and change. Nothing old, nothing rigid, nothing inflexible, nothing incapable of change. Sounds pretty good. Where are we today? And why are we here and not there? The question. And he gives the answer in this chapter. Why can't we have all these things now? In this chapter, he tells us the root of the problem. Understanding the problem, we also understand the solution. Divine life may, to some people, seem a little far away. So, Appa has offered a halfway point between human life and divine life. He calls it yogic life or mother's life, where a devotee today can have effectively, in the scope of human life, these attributes of joy, of knowledge, of harmony, of capacity for accomplishment with respect to what we want to do. Maybe not for immortality, but for practical purposes of a life of ever-expanding joy. Understanding the knot of matter will also tell us how to move to the yogic life, will also tell us the obstacles to move from the human life to the yogic life. So what are those obstacles? Sri Aurobindo says, well, to start with, when we look at matter and we look at spirit, it's very obvious, apparent to all of us, that they're two entirely opposite things in every respect. Spirit is all powerful. Matter just sits there like a lump and doesn't answer, and doesn't, no matter how much we abuse it, it remains what it is. It just is inert. Spirit is pure consciousness. Matter is completely unconscious. How can this and this ever come together? He says, the idea of spiritualizing matter would be absurd if they are really opposite. You just better forget it. It's like asking students to talk, building your house out of air. Unless matter in some way is related to spirit, there's no way we're going to achieve a divine life. But he says, what if the opposition between matter and spirit is only an appearance? It's not a reality. It may be a practical reality for our experience, but it's not a fundamental truth of matter. What if matter and spirit are forms of the same reality? Then, at least theoretically, we must concede the possibility of one turning into the other or relating to the other. And that's what he tells us in this chapter. That's in fact what he told us in the last chapter on matter, that the sharp division between matter and spirit is an illusion. The last line of the previous chapter is, matter is Satchidananda. Spirit is Satchidananda. If matter is really Satchidananda, then at least theoretically we have to conceive the possibility of that Satchidananda expressing in matter, appearing in matter, manifesting itself in matter, which is the basis for a divine life. He has already given us the argument. He's already explained it. We won't go back to that today. But now, in this chapter, we will look at what are the obstacles to the manifestation of Satchidananda in matter. Why matter? In what sense do we state matter does not appear to be Satchidananda, does not show the qualities of spirit that we're looking for, and then how do we untie the knot? He tells us that the world is a differentiated unity. A differentiated unity. The world is one. But the basis for that, the world is one, but expresses as many different things, many different people, many different objects, many different, from matter to life to mind, many different things, but the basis of all of them is one. The foundation of the world is not opposition or contradiction. You can say just as well that the family is a differentiated unity. Those who are in the family know how unique every member of the family is. How different. To outsiders, they may say, oh, that family, they're all like that. But within the family, everyone knows each one is uniquely different. But that difference is based on a oneness. In the story, we see that the Bennett family, the difference between Lydia and Kitty and Jane and Elizabeth looks to be an evolutionary difference. They're in different worlds. But when we look deeper, we see there is a oneness, there is a commonality in the family. They all have that energy. They all have that cheerfulness. They have all grown up in the freedom. Jane expresses the beauty. Lizzie expresses the intelligence. Lydia expresses the raw courage and energy. But we recognize, yes, they're common. They're drawing common resource and expressing different attributes of it. We also see in this story a great truth of life, that hate and love are not really opposites. All great traditions have said it, Mother Shurabindo have said it, old wisdom. If hate and love were really opposites, one could never turn into the other. But all too often, love becomes hate, or hate becomes love, and in this story we see Lizzie's hate for Darcy becoming love for Darcy, and Darcy's disdain for her tolerableness and disgust at her family becoming love. So if there's any opposition between to love, it's indifference. It's very difficult to convert indifference into love. But hate is already an intense relationship. He says the world is constantly trying to reconcile what we see as opposites. Lizzie and Darcy are a good example of that movement. The whole story is an example of trying to reconcile the conflict between the classes. Where does that come from? That urge for reconciliation comes because at a deeper level, we know we are parts of the same thing. We know we are really one at a deeper level. And therefore, however much we try to take care of ourselves and look out for ourselves, we always end up having to come to terms with everybody else, with the bigger reality. There's no escaping from that oneness. And he says, the goal of this whole world movement is a harmony that will manifest on surface. It will not just be a hidden secret oneness, but the secret will in nature is moving to bring that to the surface where it can fully manifest its potential. We can look forward to a world where there's no superior and inferior. There's no classes. There may be many cultures, but there'll be no sense of one is superior to the other. Each will make its own contribution. every single individual we will discover. I don't know if you have, any of you have discovered it yet. But if you really try to understand and relate to another individual without the ego's sense of judgment, you find that every individual you relate to seems to be unique and has some unique capacity. Marsh saw that every soul who came in front of her, she saw the soul's uniqueness and brought it out. The only other person I know who has, that's what Appa does. Whoever he meets, he sees and finds their strength, their capacity, and brings it to the surface. And if we can do that, what do? We choose people who are like ourselves. Ah, you're very intelligent. You agree with everything I say. Feel comfortable that way. Instead of realizing that all the things that come to us, all the opposing viewpoints, all the people who disagree with us, all the people who think that we're all wrong, have a great deal to teach us, they are parts of us that offer us a great truth and discovery. So he says in this chapter, matter and spirit are of one substance. One substance. Well, for us, matter is substance. You ask me what substance? This is substance. What is spirit? It's something like air, except it's not even that much. It's something that doesn't exist, but it's very important. I know that. I can't see it. I can't touch it. I can't do anything with it. But they say, he says it's everywhere, so it must be everywhere. He says spirit is substance. He says spirit is the original substance. And that all other substance is only an appearance or a form that spirit takes. Then what is substance? He tells us actually in the last chapter, it's not an easy idea to get. The best way I would describe it is substance is what you see when you look in the mirror, when spirit looks in the mirror. When spirit wants to work on itself, when I want to comb my hair, I go to the mirror. There's not much left, but still I go to the mirror. In order to work on myself, I go to the mirror so that I can see an image of myself as an object. Well, spirit wants to work on itself, and the work it wants to do, it wants to manifest itself as a world, and it wants to have the joy of evolution in the world, and it wants to have the joy of a play of increasing delight in the world. And in order for that, it needs to be able to see itself. It needs to be able to relate to itself as if it were an object, not one object, millions of objects. And when spirit relates to itself, now I want to be a universe and I want to relate to myself as a universe, it becomes substance. Substance is the form in which consciousness works on itself. He says matter and spirit are two poles of substance. Actually, we're going to see in the next chapter that there's an ascending series of substance. It's not that you get black or white. All the way from black to white and all the colors of the rainbow in between, there's a whole series of substances. In fact, there's a whole hierarchy of worlds, from the physical world to Satchitananda, the supramental world and Satchitananda. We may not see them, but we live in them. And if they weren't there, we wouldn't be. Because we don't see them with our senses, we're not so aware, but I think you'll recognize as we discuss it, that we live in many worlds, not just in the physical world. Man does not live by bread alone, they say. So one way to imagine this is, let's say that matter is ice. Ice is substance. That's something we can understand. Matter is clear, rigid, solid substance. What is water? Water also is there. You can touch it, you can feel it, it's tangible, but it doesn't have the rigidity and fixity of ice. And if we don't know that water and ice are the same thing, we know because somebody found out and told us when they or we got a fridge and found out that way. But if somebody doesn't know that and sees ice for the first time, what is this funny thing, very cold thing? Oh, it's only water. Don't talk nonsense. I'm not a fool. If matter is like ice, we can say life is like water. What is life? Our emotions, our feelings. There's a big difference between feeling your body and feeling your emotion. I'm afraid, I'm angry, I'm hungry, I'm in love. But that's also very concrete. It's at least as concrete as the water. It's tangible to me, even if you see it. It's real to me. So water's like ice. What about our thoughts? Thoughts are... Sometimes some people see their thoughts. I got a thought. How do you know you got a thought? I lost the thought. Where did you lose it? How can you lose something if you didn't have it? Where is it? Just put that thought aside for a minute. How can you put a thought aside? Unless it's a thing, how can you put it aside? Why don't you combine these two thoughts together? How can you combine things together unless they really exist? Thoughts are another form of substance. Maybe by analogy we can say thoughts are like steam. Thoughts are like the clouds in the sky, which is water vapor. It took a long man time for man to discover that the cloud in the sky is really just water. It's another form of ice, but it's very rarefied. And that's what we think. If ice is like matter, our thoughts are like clouds. Here they're very hard to, you can't grab them, they keep changing. When you try to approach them, they disappear. If you fly in the plane and you go through a cloud, you see the clouds from a distance. But when the plane goes into the cloud, you don't see the cloud. You only see some vague mist. It loses its form. That's like our thought. Then what is spirit? Spirit to us is like a vacuum. There's neither water nor ice nor vapor nor cloud. It's like outer space. Only thing is, we know that that outer space is not really empty. That outer space is filled with infinite potential that has not yet taken form. So we can understand that there can be multiple levels of substance of different qualities to them. He says that the way in which we experience substance depends on our sense relationship to it. There is one substance which is Satchidananda. We can experience it as ice or water or clouds, or maybe we'll only see it as a vacuum of outer space, according to the senses with which we relate to it. In the last chapter, he said that matter is the way Satchidananda sees itself when it looks in the mirror, using mind and the physical senses. Satchidananda looks at himself in the mirror through his eyes, or our eyes. He uses the physical sense, like Darcy when Bingley tries to get the gets him to dance with Elizabeth. He said, why don't you look dance with her? She's very pretty. He looks at her through the physical sense and through his mind. His mind already tells him all these are low-class people. Nobody's dancing with her, so she couldn't be very special. And what does he see? She's tolerable. Later on, he starts admiring her fine eyes. I don't think it was the color of her iris that he was admiring. He was seeing a light in her eyes. He was seeing her intelligence. He was seeing her liveliness. Not with the physical sense. When Carolyn looked, what fine eyes, I don't know what you're saying. They look very ordinary to me, a little too small, maybe a little too dark. I don't know what this nonsense is. By what standard do you say these are fine eyes? Obviously, he's not looking at it with the physical sense. The same face that was tolerable suddenly becomes fine. Later on, he begins to look at her with her through his emotional senses, his five senses. This girl is full of energy, full of liveliness, full of vitality. And he's strongly drawn to her. And at a further level, he begins to relate to her from the depths of his being. And he says, she's a goddess. I can't live without her. I can live without anything, but not without Lizzie. She's a soulmate. So how we see what we relate to depends on the faculty we use in order to experience it. And essentially what Sri Aurobindo's saying is, when we relate to Satchidananda through mind and physical senses, we see it as material reality. When we relate to it through our vital senses, we perceive it as light, emotion, impulses, sentiments, sensations, feelings. When we look at it through our mental sense, we perceive thought, ideas, values, ideals. And when we look at it directly through our spiritual sense, we see it's all Satchidananda. This is essentially what he told us in the previous chapter, and the next chapter. But for us, what's important is to know that the knot of matter very much depends on the faculty we use to relate to it. And when we say that matter can change, it can change because we have a capacity, as Darcy, Elizabeth remained the same Elizabeth. Even to the end of the story, she remains pretty much the same Elizabeth. What changed is Darcy. He started using different faculties in order to discover what he thought was matter was really Satchidananda. Okay, it all sounds very nice in theory. As friend Venkatesan says, it's all good philosophy, but now let's come to practice. When we come to practice, things don't seem so easy. And in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo says, let's not try to cover over the difficulty. Let's not try to pretend it's a simple matter. Let's really look at the difficulty square in the eye. Face it, and find out how we're going to overcome it. He said, even if we agree that in a theory the matter is only spirit, in practice, the material life we lead still appears to be the very opposite of spirit. So much so that all the religious traditions, the spiritual traditions have said, this is a hopeless case. Any kind of divine life is going to be a life in heaven, not a life on earth. Let's not waste our time. Mostly they turn away from life with disgust, despair, because our life is gross, limited. First of all, we're subject to death. When we're not dying, we're still feeling pain.
We're half blind.
Maybe he's being polite. We're more than half blind. But anyway, we're ignorant in so many respects. Where's the question of divine life? Well, he tells us the knot of matter essentially consists of three difficulties. I decided I don't need PowerPoint today because only three words that we need to get. The whole chapter is summarized in three words. Ignorance, inertia, division. The whole knot, this is the knot of matter. Ignorance, inertia, and division. Only thing is, we need to understand what he means by those words and why it's that way and how it's distorting our view of reality, and then, of course, how we come out of it. Ignorance is the first fundamental opposition of matter to spirit. Spirit is pure consciousness. Matter is pure insensibility. We can count on it all day. We can abuse it all day. We plead with it all day. It remains with and what it is, unmoved, unchanging. It doesn't even have the satisfaction of refusing. It doesn't take note of anything. It's completely oblivious. The consciousness of spirit is there in matter, but it's buried. It's buried so deep. You might say in some traditions that say Buddha said it was sleeping. It's so deeply buried that it doesn't hear anything that's going on or take note of anything that's going on. Says it's like we are when we get lost in something, when we get so absorbed in a work we're doing or a movie we're watching or whatever, or somebody that we feel affectionate about or a daydream, wishful thinking we're having, we get lost and nothing else. We're not aware of that. Mama, you're not listening to any word I say. It's self-involved in itself. Because of that, matter is a brute. You may feel other people are brutes. What is it? You're all eating and you didn't give any food to me. Matter never takes note of anything or anybody around it. It never thinks of a second person. It never cares of anything around it. It just goes its own way. If it happens to be moving and you're in the way, it just roll over you. It doesn't have any hesitation. It seems to have no purpose. For us, we value purpose so much. But this is something that does seems to exist for no purpose at all. At least it may have a purpose for us. Very convenient. I have something to sit on and something to lean on and something to walk on. But matter itself doesn't seem to have any idea of its purpose, why it's here, what it's for, what it's doing. It just is. It's being pushed around and following some laws, some principles which it doesn't know anything about. It has no heart to feel. It has no mind to think. But it's very, very powerful because we live in matter. We live in the material body, and that inconscience and ignorance and limitation of matter imposes itself on everything we do and everything we are. Because of matter, we are very ignorant. First of all, for approximately one-third of our lives, we are not even awake because of matter. Life doesn't need to sleep. Our mind doesn't need to sleep. It's the body that sinks us down into unconsciousness. So write off one-third of it just because of matter. Because of matter, we so easily forget things. Because of matter, when we get tired, we can't think. I'm too tired to think. Even when I'm not tired, thinking is hard. When I'm tired, there's no question of, I'm sorry, I'm not thinking clearly because I'm very tired. But most of the time I'm not thinking clearly because even when I wake up in the morning, I say I'm not yet awake, so I'm not thinking clearly. I'm hungry, so I'm not thinking clearly. For one reason or another, thinking clearly is difficult all the time because matter is that all the time. Because of the ignorance of matter, when Darcy sees Elizabeth, he says she's taller of the opportunity of a lifetime. The divine has come to him as a soulmate, and he says she's tolerable. Because she's disguised in matter. What she is hidden from his view because he's in matter and he sees only the material form of her. Because of matter, Elizabeth says that Wick is a very good man. Anybody so handsome must be good. Her ignorance is there because she takes the form, the outer appearance, and mistakes that for the reality, as we do. Oh, that man is a very good man. I would trust him with my life. He said, I'm the most intelligent man he's ever met. You see, he has good judgment. We judge people by how they relate to us, by how they appear to us. Because of matter, Mr. Bennett rejects Lizzie's warning about Lydia. What is it? Who could be interested in that girl? After all, it's just a trip to Brighton. The colonel is there. He's a responsible man. We're blind. We don't see what's waiting for us. Because of matter, when Darcy takes leave of her at Lambton Inn, she says, well, it's all over. I'll never see that man again. Because of matter, the moment an event is passed, it's gone for us. It doesn't exist anymore. Back in 1974, my aunt became a retired school teacher. She came to Pondy. She met mother on her birthday. 1 month later, she was crying to me. I had the most magnificent experience of my life. And now I can't remember it. I've lost it. For 1 month, I felt like I was in heaven on earth, and now I didn't know what to tell her. I introduced her to Papa. And Papa said, what is this thing? See, I met Mother on my birthday in January, and now it's all gone from me. Really? Can you tell me about it? And he made her read it. What were you wearing that day? What was the weather like? What kind of flowers did you bring to Mother? What did you see? How did she treat you? And with the end of 15 minutes, she felt she was in the room with Mother again, and the whole experience was back. But it's because of our physical consciousness that what was the most real, wonderful experience of our life, the next morning, I had this wonderful meditation, great peace, great joy, great clarity of mind, and the next morning, I'm back to normal. Because of matter. So ignorance is the first great knot that matter poses to us, which prevents us from having a divine life. And unless we overcome the ignorance of the physical consciousness, divine life, even yogic life, is not possible. The second characteristic is inertia. Inertia means, we normally think of inertia as something that doesn't move. But that's not really the meaning of inertia. Matter moves all the time. Matter is in constant movement. In fact, the physicist tells us there is nothing but movement. I may see the bottle on the table, but the bottle is only molecules and atoms that are in constant movement. Matter is moving at light speed all the time, but it's inert. Because by inertia, what we mean is, it has no capacity to change its movement. The Earth is moving at high speed around the sun every day, and it's moving on its axis. But if you say to the Earth, can you please go in the other direction? Why don't you spin in the other direction? Why don't you slow down a little and enjoy life? It's incapable of changing over thousands of years. For a million years later, you can project where it will be on this day. and what it will be doing. It will be exactly doing what it was doing, because it has no capacity to change its own behavior. So we say it's inert. An incapacity to change. Does that sound familiar? Any of us say to our loved ones, why do you always do the same thing? Can't you just do it a little differently? I'm too old for that. That's the way I am. I'm born that way. What can I do? I had this experience and now it's fixed me in the way I am. We too know what it is to feel an incapacity to change. Inertia means a sense of helplessness. Matter gets pushed around all the time. First I put it here, then I put it there, then I throw it away. It doesn't get to throw anybody away. It's constantly being pushed around by laws that it doesn't understand, by laws of nature in a mechanical universe. Any of us ever feel great? You go to a government department and they say, you know, you have to follow this rule, that rule, that rule. You haven't filled it out form. This is the wrong form. This is the wrong day. This is the wrong category. Please come back again or don't come back again. We constantly feel that society is like that. No. You can't marry that person. It's a different caste. No, there's not enough dowry. You know, the education is not quite enough for you. Everything is fixed for us by somebody making some rules and laws and helplessly fixed and limited by them. Wickham can never forget and never escape the fact that he's the son of old Darcy Stewart. Mrs. Bennett can never escape the fact that her parents were from middle class. Everybody remembers that Gardner lives in Cheapside. Caste is like that. Mary Thorne in Trollope's novel was born an illegitimate child, and that's it for her, as was Steve Jobs. And that defines his life. And the biographer of Steve Jobs says that his whole life was defined by the fact that he was rejected by his parents and he was trying to make up for it. Some people say, I was not lucky enough to be born in America. Others say, I was not lucky enough to be born a man or a woman. I remember when, after Rajashree was living in the States for 1 year, she told me one day, she said, now I understand what luck really is. Luck is to be born in India as a man or born in America as a woman. That's inertia. Those things are not usually under our control. Because of matter, we feel subject to the pressure of life all around us. I cannot fly because of gravity. Caste determines who I can marry. My educational qualifications determine the job I can get, or what kind of loan I can get, or what type of promotion I can get. And so forth and so on. Because of matter, there's no real freedom. We always end up running against barriers. Charlotte feels that she's forced to marry Collins. What can I do? I'm 27. That's material. I have no dowry. That's also material. I'm plain looking. That's also material. So essentially, the knot of matter determines that she has to marry this guy, Collins. She says, at least he's giving me plenty of chicken. So she's content with that. And she has a parlor. Mrs. Bennett says, what is my situation? I have five daughters, and they are material substance for her, and they have to be married. Whole lot driven by this fact, this pressure of five daughters and no male child. Because of matter, our power of achievement is severely limited. Jane, when Bingley goes off to London, Jane feels really helpless. What can she do? She's a girl. She can't go running after the boy. Actually, she did go running after the boy, but it didn't work. Because of matter's inertia, life is constantly confronted by the law of death. The body's refusal to change. Life is in constant movement. Our minds are moving faster. Spirit is going faster than the speed of light. But the matter is just staying where it is. So when we're very young, the body is growing and the personality is growing. But after the age of 16, 18, 20, the body stops growing. By the age of 25, our habits are fixed. Our character is fixed. The soul, the mind and the soul keep changing, keep acquiring experience, keep developing, and gradually the body, the mind, the life, the soul get more and more out of alignment with one another until the soul decides, this body is useless for me, I can't make any more progress, this character is useless, it refuses to change, these habits are getting in the way, so I have to go and give it up and try again. So because matter's resistance to change, death is inevitable. Until we can overcome the resistance of material substance to progress, the way our mind can progress or our heart can progress. Mother says matter can be a docile instrument. Our bodies will oblige us to a large extent when we are getting very excited and want to do something. We will stay up all night. It'll watch movies even when it would prefer to be sleeping, when the vital wants something, when we're really interested in something mentally. But after a while, the body reasserts itself. The businessman who works nonstop for 2-3 weeks traveling or whatever, finally the body just collapses, illness comes, health breaks down, and it says, no, stop, enough of this. I'm not going to put up with this anymore. Ultimately, it refuses to change and reminds us that it's the boss and it sets the limits. So because of inertia, we cannot overcome our ignorance, we cannot overcome our limitations. And he says that inertia is the result of the third knot, which is the knot of division. The real reason we cannot change is we are divided from our real self. We are isolated from the reality of ourself. He's told us already that the reality is indivisible. The reality is one. But mind divides reality into so many parts and pieces. It separates you and me and all of us into separate things. We feel that we're in separate bodies. If I don't eat for myself, nobody's going to eat on my behalf. At least it won't do me any good. We also feel, after all, I have to take care of myself. When it finally comes down to the analysis, I have to make myself happy. I have to look out for myself. Mind tries to overcome this sense of division, he says. It does it in two ways. One, it tries to defeat everybody else. That's like Mrs. Bennett. If I can steal a march over Lady Lucas, then I come up. It struggles and competes like Carol and Elizabeth. Or it tries to overcome the division by clinging to everybody else, by aggregating and huddling together. Well, if I do what everybody else does, if I think what everybody else thinks, if I feel what everybody else feels, if I conform, then I won't be alone anymore. The problem is, if I decide to live only by conformity, I don't make any progress. My soul cannot express. I simply remain where I am. It becomes another form of inertia. I become the social standard. It's only the aspiring individual who grows and changes the society. Because of division, there's a constant struggle between us. Liza and Carolyn are competing for Darcy's love. Mr. and Mrs. Bennett are competing for authority in the house. Because of division, the natural law of our soul for development is not possible. Because we feel separate from everybody else. Because of division, we have selfishness. Our growth comes by self-giving. But because of division, we feel like taking it for ourselves. Because of division, we have ego. We look at things from our point of view. We act from our point of view. And therefore, we miss the opportunities that come for growth by giving. We struggle to survive, not as part of the whole, but against everybody else. Lady Catherine says, Darcy must marry Lady Anne, not Elizabeth. As if it's a failure, this is a success. Because of division, we react to everything that goes around us with the dualities. I love that man. He's nice to me. I don't like that person because he tries to take my job or take something else. Because of division, we're constantly, for every success we get, there's a failure. I got a bonus. I got a bonus of 10 to 15%. It's great. But he got a bonus of 30%. That's not fair. Then what is the use of this? If he gets a promotion, means why? What about my promotion? And now he started working under me, and now he's working over me. We become, because of division, grief. Every time we have a joy, it's followed eventually by a grief. Because of division, we're constantly straining. Because we strain, we constantly come up against our limits. Because of division, we're never satisfied like Mrs. Bennett. Whatever happens, we're not satisfied. Because of division, our knowledge is always partial, and we're always having doubts about things and about the reality. So these are the three fundamental knots. And what is the result of that? Sri Aurobindo summarizes this in his little book, The Mother, when he talks about the attributes of the physical consciousness, our friends. And he says, these are not attributes of you or me or that person or somebody else. These are attributes of all of us. None of us can escape from these beautiful, wonderful attributes because of the physical consciousness of human nature. It's all very flattering to us as human beings. He starts very nicely. Stupidity. And I testify, stupidity has nothing to do with intelligence because the very intelligent people are equally or stupid. Doubt. No matter how much we know, no matter how many times Mother shows us, no matter how many times we see something, the next time around, that's true, it did happen, I think, it, I remember it, but there's always a but. We're always capable of doubt. It's the physical consciousness that doubts. Disbelief. I'll believe it when I see it. Then it's not belief. Obscurity. The physical is thick and dull. I know it, but I can't remember it. Something is in the way. There's some kind of a cloud or a fog. We live in a fog. we live in the fog of the physical consciousness that prevents us from remembering, prevents us from seeing, prevents us from feeling the truth. Obstinacy. We're all very reasonable people, but we're also very stubborn. Very stubborn. No, I know what's right. We'll do it this way. You may give 10 valid arguments, but still, we'll do it this way. Pettiness. He's very kind to pettiness. No thing is too small for the physical consciousness to make an issue of. There is nothing so small that I cannot get disturbed about it or upset about it or go to war about it or have a quarrel about it. Because of the physical consciousness takes the smallest thing and can blow it up into the biggest issue because of pettiness. Laziness. You'll do it tomorrow. Why not next year? Yes, I know it's right, we should do it, but later. Unwillingness to change. We are very willing and eager for everybody else to change. But when it comes around to yours truly, later. And that all can be summarized in the great Indian, with the greatest Indian wisdom. I don't think there's any other language that has a word for it, tamas. Tamas is the guna of the physical consciousness. He says, because of these qualities, we are subject to the law of pain. Why does pain come? Pain comes because we're ignorant. I got a new knife and I didn't know how sharp it was and cut myself 3 times because it was like a razor. Pain comes because of inertia. We refuse to change. 25 years, Mr. Bennett continues to behave in the same way with his wife, and until the family is destroyed by Linda's elopement, he's unwilling to change his behavior or even his thinking. It takes calamity to get us out of orbit into a new orbit. And then we stick to the new orbit just like the one we moved out of. Because of this physicality, we can never be satisfied. Because the true satisfaction that we're looking for can only come when we discover the spirit. The true joy can only come when we have that ananda of the spirit in everything, in every moment. So no matter how much we try to satisfy ourselves, I'm a little tired today, I'll just sleep for another hour, or I'm a little hungry today, I'll take one more dosa. No matter how much we try to satisfy yes, I know we have a lot of money, but another 1 crore will, or 100 crores, or 1,000 crores, still it will be better. Whatever we do, we are never capable of that satisfaction because we're seeking for satisfaction in the terms of the ignorance, in the terms of inertia, in the terms of the division. So the suffering that we experience, Sri Aurobindo says, don't worry about matter and don't feel sorry for it because it doesn't suffer at all. It's quite content. You can't even say it's content because in order to be content, you have to be conscious. It doesn't have any problem. Need not feel sorry for it. If we're going to feel sorry for anybody, we'll feel sorry for ourselves because we're conscious that we're not content. We're conscious that we are in the ignorance, that we have limited power, that we're not enjoying. We don't know all we should know. We don't feel all we should feel. We don't have all the power that we want. He said that suffering arises because consciousness is awakening in us. Our suffering is not because we're material. where suffering comes because we're becoming aware that we're not all we should be, that we're not perfect. Lydia doesn't have that problem. She's very happy where she is. Mr. Collins doesn't have that. He thinks he's perfect. Suffering comes only when we become aware of our imperfections, meaning when we gain some knowledge. So instead, suffering is divine. Not that we should cling to it, not that we should make a habit of it, but our awareness that we are destined for something better. So mother is there, then I should be filled with joy. I don't feel just totally filled with joy today. What's wrong with me? Where am I lost in the falsehood? Where am I lost in the ignorance? It's the soul awakening. Something better than this. There's a sunlit path. This moment must be a moment of joy. This day must be a day of self-discovery. I must be walking in the light and seeing the rasa in everything, feeling it in everything. Discovering the unique individuality in everybody instead of getting irritated because nobody agrees with what I say. So our suffering itself, our dissatisfaction is, you could say, a divine discontent. It's the soul in us trying to come to the surface that presses us to overcome and be better than we are. Because the soul cannot be satisfied with being finite, because it's not finite, it's infinite. And it wants the infinite enjoyment, the infinite knowledge, the infinite power, the infinite love, the infinite beauty. He says, man is a finite seeming infinity. We seem to be finite, we think we're finite, but we're really infinite, and we won't be content until we discover that infinity. When we come face to face with the appearances of matter and the not of matter, it's enough to make us give up and say, we better go for moksha. And that's very understandable because the obstacles are real. But it says, because the divine, because Satchidananda has become the universe, because it has become matter with a motive, with a reason, with a purpose to reveal itself in matter, to evolve and become conscious in matter, that's why he says the divine life is inevitable. When we're not worried about transforming our bodies, many of us are thinking about another type of substance, money. Money is a difficult thing to say exactly what it is. For most people, money means matter. Especially in India, if you say money, yes, gold. Get gold. Money is a thing. Money is a thing you mine in the earth and then wear around the neck. It's physical substance. Of course, money has many forms. It started out as gold and silver, bitcoins, later as paper currency notes, which for hundreds of years were very suspicious. People were saying something, this is not money, it's not, you can't bite it, you can't weigh it, it's only a piece of paper. Now our money has become more and more intangible, ethereal. We got the bank checks, and then we've got the credit card. Then you got the online transfer where the only thing you know about money is what you see in the internet is a number, electronic digital number. And the funny thing, it seems to work the same way as the gold coin, but it's becoming less and less physical. How is that possible? It's like, how did the stone become the plant, and the plant become the animal, and the animal become the man? Money seems to be evolving, just like life on earth, and becoming more conscious. And that's true for the same reason. Because money is not really material substance at all. Money is a power of the divine conscience. Sri Aurobindo says, money is a power of the divine. Not the only power of the divine. All power is a power of the divine. But money is something that seems to be so concrete. We see that it's far off from us. It's hard for us to conceive of it. When we think about how money is created, well, originally the money's created by hard work. If there's gold buried underground, you better dig it up. If you're not lucky enough to have a gold mine underneath, you better grow some crops and sell so you don't need to consume. And you, from there, you buy some more land and you get other people to grow crops for you. Or you go and become a soldier and steal somebody else's wealth. Or you become a craftsman and make something useful that somebody else wants. Sometime later, people found you don't have to grow anything, you don't have to mine anything, steal anything. You buy something from somebody and sell it to somebody else, and you make a profit. So it's not land you need to make money. It's not a mine you need to make money. You don't need to have a factory to make money. It's enough you have other people who want what you have. So, personally, the way money is created is no longer by physically doing something. It's by relating to other people. And if you think about it, this really makes sense, because if we didn't live in a world with other people, there would be no money. I mean, literally, there would be no money. Just transplant yourself to a deserted island where you're the only citizen for a minute. Carry all your gold, jewelry with you, all your lakhs and crores of fancy notes, your bank balance, your credit cards and everything. What will you do with it? You can't do anything with it. At least the currency notes, you can build a fire. The gold, you can't even do that. Money only exists in relationship to other people. Well, I can say this, watch exists whether any of you are there or not. I may not have any appointments if I'm all alone in the world, but at least I can know what time it is. But that's not true with money. My watch is a physical thing, the bottle of water I can drink. Money is absolutely useless. If other people are not there, then how can it be a material thing? It's not a material thing at all. Supposing I have a crore of rupees, there are a lot of things I can buy. Supposing I have a lot of friends who say, you're not having a house. You're not having a house, we'll build a house for you. Then I don't need a crore of rupees. That's not theoretical. That's what you have done for mother. You've built a house for mother in Madras. Based on what? Based human relationship. No work based on human relationship. So money can always be substituted by something else. We call it goodwill. We call it devotion. We call it family. When we're at home, we don't sell meals to our family members, hopefully. You're a member of the family, even to our guests. Come, you're our guest. Come and have meals with us. So if you have relationship with people, relationship gives you all of these things without the need for money. So what is the common base of all these things? What we really want is to live in productive harmony with other people, where we share what we have. Because without other people, I can't build a house. I can't have any food unless I'm going to grow it all on my own land and eat it myself. I can't be watching TV or going in a car. I can't be doing anything. Without other people, I cannot survive for a minute in modern society. I'm back in the jungle. Money is only a means by which, it's a system which we exchange goods with one another. You give this to me, I give that for you. In the home, we don't need money. We don't exchange for money. Outside, so that we can relate to more and more people, we relate to one another through money. It's a system to help us relate to one another. But like matter, there's lots of money. We are subject to the same knot of money that we are the knot of matter. We think it's a physical thing. We don't realize it's Satchidananda. We think, because we think that matter is separate, unconscious, inert, ignorant, it behaves that way. Our job is to release the consciousness and discover the soul in that matter. Money also is, in its essence, pure consciousness. And in the measure we relate not to the physical form of money, but to the consciousness of money, release the power of money from the knot of physicality, and we see that money can be multiplying ad infinitum. And when Appa says that every devotee can get 100 crores, he doesn't mean from growing crops in the field or making shoes or even trading, because the reality of money is pure consciousness. Through MMC has come up. Through pure mother's consciousness, that money can be created. We believe, as an American, I really believe money comes from work. Money comes, many people believe, from status. In India, it's very prevalent. Money comes from bribe. If you want to earn money, you have to be corrupt. And without that, these are simply superstitions, because we don't understand what really money is. We see many people in the world, the people who are earning the most in the world, are not growing anything or producing anything. They're sitting in an office and thinking. We call them investment bankers. The average investment banker at Goldman Sachs was earning about $5 million a year without ever crossing the room or going anywhere. And there was one, their top earner, I can't remember, it came out to be something like he was making $33 million an hour. An hour. Investment banker at the, I forget, the, I don't know the name. Buffett may be earning that much or more. Yeah. So we know that money can be created just by thinking. Just by creatively thinking. You can attract money by being trustworthy. The original bankers got money deposited. They were all private people, not government regulated people. They were people known to be honest. If you deposit their money, they will keep it and they'll give it back. They won't spend it on their wives and on holidays and things like that. So honesty can attract money. If thought, intelligence, creativity, courage, honesty, aspiration, devotion can create money, then what is it? It's not a physical thing. It's with that knowledge that Appa says, we have the greatest, purest power, direct form, the original substance from which all wealth is created, which is pure consciousness. When we have faith in work, we have to work. When we have faith in trade, we have to trade. When we have faith in being clever or faith in being corrupt, then we have to get what we can get that way. But we have an endowment worth million times more that can be directly converted into money. How it will express is different. Maybe it will be the value of the land going up, which has been happening to so many people. So many ways may be there. But our faith should be, our knowledge should be, that Mother's consciousness is pure wealth. That's the knowledge we should have to overcome the ignorance of the knot of money. But there's also the division. The division is the ego. What's mine is mine. What's yours should also be mine. What I receive is prosperity. What you receive makes me poor. That's the ego. That's Mrs. Bennett's consciousness. We know it well. Because when we feel that selfishness, when we feel that possessiveness, we come out of Mother's consciousness. We lose the power to create money. That's why Appa's recurring theme is goodness and goodwill are pure prosperity. Real goodness and real goodwill take us out of treating money as a thing and recognizing that money is pure consciousness. So moving away from the ego is how we untie the knot of money. Money is only a form of Mother's consciousness. It's created directly by aspiration, goodwill, self-giving, gratitude. Mrs. Bennett gets three daughters married by what? She didn't work in the field. All the work she did was mischief and trouble. By her aspiration. Her aspiration did it. Charlotte becomes the future mistress of Longbourn because of what? Goodwill. Goodwill. Elizabeth, out of her goodwill for game, out of her aspiration and individuality, and her gratitude, good self-giving to Jane, her gratitude to Darcy, got Pemberley. It's consciousness that created this. It's not physical substance. I'd like to stop here, ask if there's any questions or comments, either from Mambalam or any other center. Ashok.
Yes.
Can you?
I remember in the Life Divine a passage that says thoughts have a very physical origin. The sensory information received by the body is relayed to the brain, and there it is converted into thought. I can accept that for elementary sensations, turning into thoughts like smell of fish comes from the kitchen and the body interprets, receives those sensations and turns that into a thought, my mother is cooking fish. But I cannot accept that such a physical origin for higher levels of creative inspiration. How can I connect Einstein's intuition about E is equal to mc square or Shakespeare's pure literary inspiration with anything physical? They seem to be clearly disconnected from the body and seem to be pure inspiration from above. Do you agree?
Absolutely correct. when Sri Aurobindo said that thoughts come from the body, but he doesn't mean that all thought comes from the physical. Most of what we do and we call thought is from the physical, because we live in the physical consciousness. But E equals MC squared and Shakespeare's sonnet and the Bhagavad Gita and life divine are not originating in the body. Thought can come not only from the physical, it can come from our emotions or our feelings. The love poet who feels an intense inspiration of the beauty of life or romantic love, his thought originates from the emotional center. Thought can originate from the mind, pure mind. The philosophy of a philosopher is not from the physical. It can originate from the supramental plane, from any plane, from the intuitive field. So I fully agree with what you said.
Okay.
For our purposes, the key is that most of our thought, most of what we think, what we call thinking, is very much encumbered by the ignorance of matter. That's why I quoted that simple statement which we all use, I'll believe it when I see it. It's not happened, therefore it's not real to me. What we call real is what's real to the physical. Physical is the least real part of us. But because our thinking is physical, we consider something real only when it's tangible. It's a very good point and central to understanding the knot of matter. Any other questions, comments? Thanks, Ashok. In the next chapter, he's going to come back to this point about substance and tell us that actually the whole world is an ascending series of substance. We've got matter at the bottom, let's say, and spirit at the top, so there's no top and bottom. And in between, we've got life, which we know. We can't see it. We can't measure it, but it's very real to us because that's where we live. That's the center of our existence. We've got mind, which is another plane. And beyond that, we've got the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the overmind, the supramind, all of which are worlds, real worlds, in which we live. We live mainly in the vital. Even more than in the physical, we live in the vital. We live in our sensations. We live in our feelings. We live in our impulses. But our consciousness is there in all of these planes. And this is the ascending series. He calls it in Savitri. Book 2 of Savitri is called The World Stair, where he describes his own experiences in each of these worlds. And he describes the world. And each world has its own substance. Each world has its own form. In each world, you can walk around and sit in a room or run on the field. You have your own body. But they're not physical. They're vital, mental, and other forms. Each world has its own forces, its own reality. Next one. Okay.